Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Rafe Sagarin. Rafe Sagarin, PhD, is a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst at the University of Arizona. Among his many accolades, Dr. Sagarin has won a 2011 Guggenheim Fellowship to support his work on natural security, and he was a Congressional Science Fellow in the office of U.S. Representative Hilda Solis. Dr. Sagarin has taught ecology and environmental policy at Duke University, California State University, Monterey Bay, and University of California, Los Angeles. His research has appeared in Science, Nature, Foreign Policy, and other leading journals, magazines, and newspapers. Dr. Sagarin's presentation today is based on his new book, Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. Please welcome Rafe Sagarin.
Thank you. Feedback. Okay. Well, I'm very excited to be here, and I'm looking forward to talking with you, not just delivering my remarks to you, but also in any discussion we have. I find that a lot of these ideas take a little time to percolate. You develop new ideas as you think about them, and sometimes it's a couple days or a couple weeks or a couple months later that you find some connection to what I've been talking about, and that's why I've put up my email. It's rafe@email.arizona.edu because most of the learning I do in this process has been from interactions with audience members and various collaborators who have seen me talk about this, and that often spins me out onto new directions. So I welcome your comments and questions, not just tonight, but at any time. Now, this work is based on a fairly straightforward question, which is, what can we learn from nature about how to be adaptable in our own society? This is not a radically new question in the field of life sciences. It's just sort of a question that's been forgotten for a while. And because this is a California audience, I'll talk about Ed Ricketts, who I hope some of you know about Ed Ricketts, because he represents sort of the early way that life scientists saw no disconnect between the organisms that they studied in nature and human societies and human interactions and human relationships. Now, Ed Ricketts was a marine biologist in the early 20th century. He was a very good friend of John Steinbeck and of Joseph Campbell. It would be hard to imagine the ideas of Joseph Campbell or Steinbeck coming out with such force without their friendship with Ed Ricketts. He was incredibly influential on them, and he wrote a lot himself about these connections between human societies and the animal communities he studied. And I think this quote is appropriate, where he says, "A study of animal communities has this advantage. They are what they are for anyone to see who can and will look clearly. They cannot complicate the picture with worded idealisms, saying one thing and being another." So he really saw this advantage of studying natural communities because they didn't have this political shell around them that kind of complicated how you looked at them. And so I take inspiration from that, not just because I'm a marine biologist who cut my teeth in the shadow of Ricketts' lab in Cannery Row, but also because he did care so much about making these connections, which we largely forgot about for much of the 20th century, where science became ever more reductionist into molecules and trying to find fixed rules. And we're starting to open up the life sciences again to this kind of thinking. So I hope that my work can contribute on that a little bit. Now, getting back to the question of adaptation, I say that adaptation is about leaving your comfort zone or being forced from it. So if you think about these early amphibians coming out of these prehistoric seas that were full of predators, they are both being forced from their normal comfort zone and also seeing opportunity or a chance to exploit new niches or ways of living. So it's kind of a push and a pull. And if I think about how myself as a marine biologist became interested in security issues, it really is the same type of thing, because my own comfort zone was right down the road in the tide pools of Monterey Bay, where I studied how natural communities were responding to climate change. And there I was in these gorgeous tide pools on the morning of 9/11 and feeling very disconnected from what was going on there, what my close friends and family members were experiencing as they were trying to get out of the Capitol building where they were working, trying to get out of the State Department where they were working, and I felt like I was in another world. But less than a year later, I found myself far outside my own comfort zone, working on Capitol Hill as a science advisor. And I was working for U.S. Congresswoman Hilda Solis in her first and second term. She's now our labor secretary. And her main issues back then, as they are now, were labor and environmental issues. So I thought I'd come up there and work with her on those issues. But in that particular Congress, those issues actually had no traction whatsoever. Congress that wasn't so different ideologically than our current Congress. And I found myself with a lot of time on my hands to do my own studies of Washington, D.C. And I basically acted like I would in my tide pools. I acted like a naturalist. I observed what was going on. I recorded what was going on. I looked for changes. And what I saw at that time was what I call an ecology of fear. That is, everywhere there was new signs of security popping up. Jersey barriers would emerge like fungus around national monuments every single day. A new monument would be surrounded by these things. New metal detectors everywhere. New guards everywhere. And yet, I witnessed this and observed it with a growing sense of unease. Because unlike the tide pools that I had studied, which every day are different in many different ways and continually change, and the organisms there are continually adapting, I saw these new security measures go up, and then they stayed the same. So much so that staffers, for example, on the Hill learned that if I walk through the metal detector with my hand over my keys in my pocket, it won't set it off, and then I don't have to put the keys through the belt. So I thought, wow, if Capitol Hill staffers would adapt just to save 30 seconds every morning, imagine what a terrorist would try to do to get around these rather static security systems that we were developing. And that led me thinking about the larger process of biological adaptation, because I knew all organisms in nature are continually escalating in response to their adversaries, predators escalating in response to prey species defenses and vice versa. So then I sort of ran into a conundrum, which is this, and it's related to the fact of why I like biology so much as a career, and that is, despite my so-called expertise in this tide pool animals of the Pacific, I recognize that that is such a tiny slice of the whole biological world and all those biological processes that I actually knew close to nothing about biology. And if I thought I knew close to nothing about biology after a career in it, I absolutely knew I knew nothing about security. So I knew I had to rely on other people to help me figure this problem out. And so what I did is I brought together some of the most creative minds across the life sciences that I could find. And these were biologists, behavioral ecologists, anthropologists, psychologists, and just about anyone I could find who was interested in applying their knowledge across the board, as well as the same type of people from the security world. So former spies, public health people, cybersecurity people. And I brought them all together in this place called NCES, which is the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis in Santa Barbara. It's like a think tank where most of the problems tackled have to do with large-scale environmental issues, like can we quantify the state of forests in the world, the state of deforestation around the world. But they took a chance in funding my crazy idea for a working group, which was just as the first question said, what can we learn from nature about how to be more adaptable to security threats in society? And these discussions became the seed for a growing series of discussions with a growing audiences of practitioners and analysts in the security field and more scientists coming to this group. And they formed the seed for our ideas. And what surprised me was that despite the fact that we were very open-ended and dealing with anything from biology, including our own development as a species, to get some ideas, that despite that diversity, we coalesced around a few key ideas that seemed almost universal in adaptable biological systems. So what I'm going to talk about is some of these general ideas, and then we're going to drill down into the specifics of how you become adaptable. The first major idea is simply this, that nature faces the same problem that all of us do, and that is that risk is ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and it's largely unpredictable. Nature has been surviving and thriving for 3.5 billion years, despite all this risk, despite the complete unpredictability. And so that's just the impetus for us to say there's a lot to learn from nature out there, and we've largely ignored all of these potential lessons. Drilling down a little more, we say that the world is full of unpredictable risk, but a fish doesn't try to turn a shark into a vegetarian. Now, what do I mean by that? A fish will do anything in its power to avoid that shark or avoid getting eaten by that particular shark, but it implicitly doesn't try to get rid of the general problem of predation, which is a generalized risk in your world. And what we tend to do a lot is try to tackle the whole problem at once, try to tackle the whole issue of risk. We declare a war on terror. We declare a war on drugs. We declare a war, in my field, on invasive species. Yet all of these are very generalized risks that we can't just eliminate by winning some war on them. Species and nature focus on the problem at hand, and that's a topic I'll return to again and again. Now, here are three things that natural species don't do, which stand in kind of stark contrast to the way we try to deal with problems. Natural organisms don't plan, they don't try to predict the future, and they don't try to be perfect. So, as Exhibit A in that first point, I put up the mola mola, the ocean sunfish. And if I asked any of you to plan a fish, you would never come up with a ridiculous fish like this. Look at it. Doesn't look like a fish. It's weird. It's slow. And yet, this has been an incredibly successful fish. It's lived for millions of years. It's the largest bony fish. It has been successful by adapting to solve problems in its environment and filling a niche that hadn't been filled before. Natural organisms also don't predict the future. You might have seen reports that animals before the Asian tsunami predicted the tsunami. Well, they didn't exactly predict the tsunami when they were acting strangely well before humans knew what was going on. They just have a very keen observational sense of what their environment should be like and are able to detect changes in that much more keenly than we are. And that's an important aspect of being adaptable, as I'll get into. And you'll often hear on nature documentaries things like, the great white shark is the perfect predator. And I always say, really? I think it'd be a lot more perfect if it had laser beam eyes. But in fact, it's almost impossible to measure what would be the perfect organism for every single change that happens in nature. There's no goal of perfection. There is no survival of the fittest. It is survival of the good enough to reproduce yourself, the good enough to solve the challenges in your environment. We spend, by contrast, a lot of time on optimization and trying to perfect processes. and we waste a lot of energy doing so. Now, all of us would love to be more adaptable. This term, adaptability, is being thrown around a lot now. We say, oh, you know, borders, they should have been more adaptable to the changing business climate, but they weren't. We'll say some organization should have been more adaptable. This government agency needs to be more adaptable. But beyond that, behind throwing around this term that sounds good, yeah, be adaptable, we don't really know what adaptability is or how to do it. And so what we're trying to do here, what I try to do with the book, is to break down this idea of adaptability into key component parts that we can use in our everyday lives, no matter what we do. So the first concept of adaptability, which comes from this remarkable member of my working group named Gary Vermeij. Vermeij is a professor at UC Davis. He's a paleobiologist. He is an incredible naturalist, probably one of the best certainly the best naturalist I know. He can identify any species of just about anything that you put in his hands, and you have to put it in his hands because he's been blind since he was 3 years old. He has this incredible tactile sense, and he uses that not just to identify and list species, but also to look at their whole history and the history of life throughout millions of years and look for patterns in that history of life. And one of the things he finds consistently is that the most adaptable organisms are fairly decentralized. They rely on a number of semi-independent parts to sense change in the environment and respond to it. And this is why I put the octopus as sort of a central metaphor in this book, because they express this decentralized nature fairly well. Now, an octopus has a beautiful brain. It has a wonderful central mind. It even is cognitive, in a sense. It's quite clever, but it doesn't do all its adaptation using its mind. For example, it doesn't swim over a coral reef and say from its brain, arm one, you better turn red now, and arm two, turn kind of pinkish. Rather, it has millions of skin cells spread over its body, which are each themselves observing the change in their little world and responding to it in shape and color, so that the octopus as a whole is becoming camouflaged to that reef it's going over. This is not unlike our immune system, which has a bunch of cells running around our body looking for invaders and responding to them without any back and forth to our central brain. Still part of our body, still serving our body, but with all these independent sensors. Now, we tend to do just the opposite when we're threatened. We tend to centralize everything and trust on a whole bunch of experts to tell us what to do. And that's certainly the case after 9/11. We created a system that's nothing like the octopus's skin, which is the Department of Homeland Security, which is your typical top-down, centralized bureaucracy with a lot of boxes. And someone down in these boxes has to go up and down this chain of command to do anything. And we saw that very clearly in the first major test of Homeland Security after Katrina, which was Hurricane Katrina. I mean, the first major test of security after 9/11, which was Hurricane Katrina. And the big question there was, where is FEMA? And if you want to find a government agency, you've got to go to the org chart. There's FEMA way down in that stack of boxes. That back on track. Yeah. So FEMA's down around here. These boxes aren't trivial things. One of these boxes is the Coast Guard. So if you wonder why FEMA had so much trouble responding quickly to the changes in Katrina, part of it is because they were in this very centralized organization. Now, related to this idea is that nature uses a lot of redundancy to solve many types of problems. In society, we tend to think of redundancy as wasteful and as inefficient. But nature doesn't have abundant resources to throw around, and yet consistently throughout the history of life, we see a lot of redundancy in nature. There is fairly simple redundancy, like this centipede, which has multiple walking legs. And that's fine. Centipedes are fine. They've done fine. But they haven't been nearly successful as their cousins, the beetles. Beetles are so successful that once the biologist J.B.S. Haldane was asked, what do your studies of nature tell you about the Creator? And he said, well, he must have an inordinate fondness for beetles. Because beetles are everywhere. They've been an evolutionary tour de force. And they do so by spreading this redundancy into creative solutions. So they have wings to fly, and they have claws, and they have walking legs, and they have devices for shooting chemical weapons. So it's this combination of multiple ways of seeing a problem and multiple ways of responding to a problem that gives you a core of adaptability that you can work on. And there are some examples from society of how to do this really well. Google is a great example. I was just over there today. Google is a company that is designed from the bottom up to be an adaptable company. One of the things they did for many of their early years was require that all their managers and engineers spent 20% of their time doing something completely different than their day job. So 20% of their paid time had to go to a project that was completely different, which helped you build that creative redundancy or new ways of solving problems. One of those projects became Google Flu Trends. Google Flu Trends uses the other part of adaptable systems, which is having all those semi-independent sensors. That's you and I searching things on Google, and they're watching us search these things, and they're looking for when we're searching things like, does my kid have flu? What are flu remedies? What are flu symptoms? And when we're searching those things a lot, Google Flu Trends shows spikes. And those spikes and troughs on when we're searching or not searching for flu-related terms actually match up really well with the Center for Disease Control's data on flu, with one major exception. CDC, when they want to learn when there's flu outbreaks, they send out surveys to doctors and hospitals. And they get those surveys back to Atlanta, and they compile them, and they analyze them, and then they write a report and send out that report. The only difference, really, is that Google Flu Trends, because it's all of us searching sort of instantly, gives you this information 2 weeks before the CDC data. That is a huge advantage when you're talking about a potential pandemic of flu. Now, regardless of how well you do this decentralized searching and multiple redundant problem solving, you are going to run into the limits of your adaptability. All organisms do, and all organisms engage in symbiotic partnerships with other organisms that essentially allow them to expand their adaptability beyond what they could do themselves. Symbiosis is everywhere in nature, and it occurs often between species you would think would have nothing to do with one another, like this small cleaner wrasse, which will go right into the mouth of a larger fish, a predatory fish, and clean out parasites. Symbiosis often, we're learning, has emergent properties, so things you wouldn't expect just from the relationship of the two organisms. For example, we've just learned that these larger groupers, when they're being cleaned at a cleaning station, they're actually, not only do they not eat that little cleaner wrasse, they are also much less aggressive to all the species around that reef area. Symbiosis often occurs between species that were once in conflict. So symbiotic partnerships that we see now that are more or less cooperative may have come out long ago out of conflictual relationships. All those things are important to keep in mind when we consider how we can use symbiotic partnerships or not in society. We tend to see an enemy or an adversary, and we do things like put up a wall between them. This is the border wall right near my house in Tucson. This is down in Nogales. But I can show you from examples that creating symbiotic partnerships between groups of human beings are so powerful that they can go right through those walls. They can move straight through those walls. And one of the partnerships I'm thinking about was organized by a man who's been very closely involved with my work on this topic. His name is Terry Taylor. If I showed you his resume, his complete resume, you would understand that he used to be James Bond, I think. There's some things he can't tell me, but as far as I can trace it, he was a James Bond type who is now very interested in public health and emerging infectious diseases. He was a chief weapons inspector in Iraq as well. So he's someone who has seen both conflict from many different angles, as well as looking to increase health outcomes in the world. And one of the things he's done is facilitate symbiotic partnerships, in this case, between Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians. These are doctors and health ministers all working together to identify emerging infectious diseases and respond to them. They share information, they share patient data, they share technology and databases, because they recognize that infectious diseases don't care about what side of the border wall or what side of disputed territories they are on. Now, here's an important thing. Remember I talked about how natural organisms don't seek perfection. These guys are not trying to create peace in the Middle East. They are trying to solve an immediate problem. So by not focusing on this huge intractable issue, but focusing on what's immediately before them, they are making incredible progress on infectious diseases. And they may end up being the catalyst that moves us towards peace in the Middle East, but that's not what they're focused on now. Terry has since replicated these kind of networks in the 6 countries around the Mekong River, which are no less friendly to one another, and in countries in southern Africa. And that leads to a final point about adaptable systems, which is that the most adaptable organisms learn from success. So we're hearing a lot of clever business and management talk these days about how important it is to learn from failure. And it sounds very good and self-effacing. You know, we should learn from our failures. And that's really important. Learning from failure is an evolutionary dead end. It means you die and you haven't reproduced yourself. There's no learning there. Learning from success is a creative feedback process that builds off a kernel of success and continues to create new adaptations. Every living organism is an example of learning from the success, essentially, of its ancestors. It wouldn't be there if its ancestors weren't successful. We tend to focus overwhelmingly on learning from our failures. It is important to learn from failures. I'm not denying that. You don't want to repeat stupid things that you do. But we focus overwhelmingly on this. In the Townsend After Action report to Katrina, which was the report on what did we do in the Katrina response, there's over 100 different failures that are identified at great length and talked about in terms of what we did wrong and how we could do better. But that report does not focus at all on what went right. One of the things that went right in the Katrina response was the Coast Guard successfully contained and cleaned up a 9-million-gallon oil spill. Now, when would it be useful to know about cleaning up oil under difficult circumstances in the Gulf of Mexico? Oh, in the very next disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, which was Deepwater Horizon. So we missed an opportunity to learn from success. And that turned out to be probably the most important thing to learn from in the next big disaster there. So taking all these lessons of adaptability, we can use them as a spotlight to analyze situations and see have we been adaptable enough? And we can use them as a map to suggest how we might move forward and become more adaptable. So as an example of the former, I turn to this very difficult problem of improvised explosive devices in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is a real tragedy. What I've mapped out here is number of deaths of U.S. combat troops per month in Iraq, shown in red, and Afghanistan, shown in green. Now, when we went into Iraq, we had many plans. We had many predictions about what this war was going to look like, and that was all from the Department of Defense. But when soldiers on the ground, who in a fighting force are your semi-independent sensors, who are seeing change and trying to respond to it, got down there, they recognized very quickly that their war was nothing like the war that had been planned, nothing like the war that had been predicted, and in fact was going to be a real problem with these improvised explosive devices. So much so that very early in the war, this young specialist, Thomas Wilson from the Tennessee National Guard, confronted Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in a very public press conference. And he said, you know, we're running around there trying essentially to adapt as best as they can to this problem. We're throwing on hillbilly armor to our vehicles, which are scrap metal they would find and bolt on to these under-armored vehicles. And Rumsfeld initially responded, well, you go to war with the army you have, which was a very non-adaptable statement. But Congress got all up in arms about this. They said, you got to get our men and women the armor that they need and that they will protect them. So the Department of Defense, big top-down centralized organization, kicked into gear and went as fast as it possibly could to develop these up-armored vehicles. That took 3 years from the time of Specialist Wilson's outburst to when these vehicles, which are called MRAPs, mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, rolled out into Iraq. During those 3 years, over 1,300 troops died in Iraq just due to IEDs. Wilson and his comrades weren't waiting around for that armor to come into combat, obviously. They did a lot of different things to try to figure out this IED problem. But the most successful thing they did was eventually make symbiotic partnerships with even the people that had been shooting at them, with the people who had been creating bombs. They figured out what those guys needed, and they exchanged it for information. And as the tips to U.S. soldiers about where those bombs were and who were making those bombs reached an all-time high in this area of time, that's when you see this massive decline in Iraq in IED deaths, well before these up-armored vehicles came into country. Now we've got thousands of these up-armored vehicles, and we don't know what to do with them, except that we're heating up things in Afghanistan. So let's send them all over to Afghanistan. Not such a great idea, because there aren't roads in Afghanistan that can handle 15 to 25-ton vehicles. So if you're a Taliban, and you've got a one-ton Toyota pickup truck, which is the most adaptable vehicle ever made, you can go wherever you want, and you also know that U.S. troops are always going to be on these roads that can handle these huge up-armored vehicles, which means you know where to put the bombs, you know where they're going, and you're going to learn from those successes. And tragically, that's what happened in Afghanistan. That's when you see the explosion of IED deaths. Now, thinking about how we can do things differently moving forward, how we can unleash this power of adaptability, one of the stumbling blocks for a lot of people is this idea that we're just completely different from the natural world. We're this special species. And I will absolutely admit that there's a lot of special things about us, that we have an incredible cognitive mind, that we have this group behavior that is very powerful and allows us to adapt in all kinds of ways. We're an incredibly adaptable species. We, like the Beatles, have taken over the world. But I'll say that we're different from other animals, but we're not that different. Basic genetic architecture we have is the same as most other organisms. And more importantly, the processes that we do to keep ourselves alive are really the same as organisms going back all the way to the first bacteria and the first viruses. And one of those processes is this idea of understanding self and non-self. So one of the most important things an organism can do is understand what's like itself and what's not like itself. And that ability is everywhere, and it takes on different forms in different animals. In salmon, it takes on the form of having a really good chemical sense of where your home stream is, so that you'll do anything as a salmon, knowing that, essentially, implicitly knowing that you have survived as a salmon from growing up in this home stream. You'll do anything to get back to that home stream and reproduce. It's essentially a suicidal mission to get up there. But it's the same kind of thing with humans. We have that self-non-self recognition really built into our group dynamics, and we identify very strongly with a group that we're with, especially when that group is identified against another group. So John Tooby, an evolutionary psychologist who works with us, does experiments showing that humans from different socioeconomic classes, different genders, different races, different levels of education, will nonetheless form groups with one another very strongly, very quickly, as long as they have some enemy, some outsider that they are perceived to be against. And you've all seen this. You know, freshman year at college, all of a sudden these kids from all over the world are dyed in their home team colors as if it was their strongest identity. And much less trivially, people will, in fact, on the extreme end of things, kill themselves to uphold their group identity. So it's not just about my own genes, it's about my group. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Nonetheless, we have been this incredibly adaptable species. And it's only really recently that we've lived in an environment, fortunately, where we haven't been under this constant pressure to adapt and survive. Now, those people who haven't escaped that, and here I'm specifically thinking about, for example, young soldiers, young officers who are coming back now from 10 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, these people are incredibly adaptable. And one little plug I'll put in here is if you have a company, if you have an organization, and you are not hiring these veterans, you are missing out on a huge opportunity to get someone who knows how to solve problems in incredibly difficult situations. So there are some people who are able to be adaptable because they've been forced to. There are a lot of people, over a billion people in this world, who still daily struggle to survive if you're just talking about getting their basic caloric needs. Nonetheless, a lot of us and a lot of our organizations have been insulated from that. And the question is, how do we jumpstart this process of adaptability again? And I say that it's actually a very simple process. Again, I'm not talking about tearing down our Department of Homeland Security or anything that seems unadaptable, because I'm not talking about perfect solutions. I'm talking about how do we solve problems that we need to solve. And one of the ways we do this is by stop giving orders and start issuing challenges. Orders is when a small group of so-called experts says, this is what everyone else needs to do, go do it. A challenge is when we say, here's a problem we're all facing. Who among you can figure out the best way to solve this problem? And there's a good history of challenge-based problem solving, going back at least to the 1700s, when one of the biggest problems was identifying your longitude at sea. A lot of ships were crashing, and a lot of people were dying, and a lot of treasure lost because sailors didn't know what longitude they were at. Many people thought that the great astronomers of the time, would solve this problem. But English Parliament did a wise thing. They issued a challenge with a big prize, and they said, anyone who can solve this longitude problem, let us know. And it wasn't actually astronomers who solved it. It was a watchmaker. A watchmaker who designed a very accurate chronometer that could keep time at sea turned out to be the key piece in the puzzle of identifying your longitude. Now, you don't want to create a challenge that merely comes up with some cool idea. What you want to have is a challenge and the process around that challenge that creates a system of adaptability that's not unlike a natural system in that it's perpetual, in that it continues to adapt. It's not solving one problem, but continuing to solve problems. And the way you do it when you issue these challenges is you create what I call an adaptive cascade. And this actually happens almost automatically. So you start with the challenge question. This brings in all your semi-independent problem solvers. Everyone who's been asked to solve the challenge are now those independent viewers of change and of problems. And they all have slightly different perspectives, which is a good thing, because then they bring in this creative redundancy. You have people, you have the watchmaker, you have the astronomers, you have the people with the different knowledge coming up with different types of solutions, and it often becomes the kernel for new symbiotic partnerships because someone says, well, I can solve part of this challenge, but I could do it a lot better if I was working with you or with you. So you create these partnerships that solve problems. And then if you've organized the challenge right and you've got the incentives right, you will figure out a way to reward successes. And rewarding successes creates that feedback loop, which brings you back and allows you to run new challenges, maybe more complex challenges in the next generation, maybe challenges that bring in different types of respondents. So what I want to do in the last few slides is talk about a few real examples of how challenge-based problem solving has made us much more adaptable. There are examples like DARPA. This is a small agency within the Department of Defense, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. When they want to go develop a new piece of military technology, they don't hire a single contractor, which is going to take 20 years longer than they said they would and cost billions of dollars more and come up with something that doesn't really solve the problem. And we've seen that time and time again. in this military procurement process. What they do is they say, here's a problem we're facing. Who among you can, say, design a completely autonomous vehicle that can navigate a complex course? And they've done these kind of challenges. They have prizes of something like $1 million, which is couch change to the Department of Defense. And usually the respondents, typically engineering departments from different colleges, probably spend more than $1 million solving these challenges, but they want to solve these challenges. There's a prestige involved in it, and this is something you see again and again with challenge-based problem solving. It costs much, much more. It's much, much more cheap than you would expect because people want to solve problems if the challenge has been defined right. You also get results much faster, and you get many unexpected types of solutions. Again, thinking about that creative redundancy. 3M discovered this. 3M is by no means a Google-style company. It's a fairly standard blue-chip kind of company. But when they wanted to reduce their environmental footprint, they didn't have the CEO send out a memo to everyone saying, everyone reduce your paper use by 20%, thank you. They asked anyone in the company to come up with any idea that would reduce their environmental footprint. So you had administrative assistants over here saying, oh, we could reduce our paper by a ton if we just did this. And you had chemists over here saying, you know, if we just rearrange these fume hoods, we would reduce chemical waste by this much. And so you had everyone in this company responding. 3M had over 8,000 successful responses to this challenge. They saved hundreds of millions of dollars. They massively reduced their environmental footprint. And all respondents got was a certificate for their participation. So talk about not needing a heavy dose of incentive. It just had to be the right challenge. In the environment, there are problems like bycatch in fisheries, which are all the things fishermen catch that they don't want to catch and that they can't sell at market because it's illegal, but they catch in their nets anyway. And it's a huge waste. Fishermen don't like it, but you can't have a government agency like NOAA just say, well, all fishermen now must reduce their bycatch by 20%. There's nothing there. But environmental groups working with fishing groups created a challenge, $50,000 to anyone who can reduce bycatch without reducing your value catch. And so you had fishermen especially, the ones who are out on the sea every day and see how this gear works and see how the fishing works, coming up with solutions, and they repeat these challenges every year. So they get more and more solutions to this problem of bycatch. And finally, in teaching, I've seen this with my own classes. Now, I've shown that slide of the Department of Homeland Security hundreds of times, and I always mocked it and get a good chuckle out of it from an audience. And then I looked at my own classroom, and I realized that it looks just like the Department of Homeland Security, because this is a typical university class. Here's the professor, that's me, up at the top. And this is my class, the green triangle, and these are all the students. And I choose maybe a couple papers from the primary literature and a government report that we're going to discuss that day, because that's what the syllabus says we're going to go over that day. And I put it into the class, and then all the students are expected to follow it and read it and respond to it. And I wonder why, you know, I've always got two or three chatty Cathys who are happy to talk in any class, but then the rest of them are just texting under their desks or whatever. And I realized, wow, it's because I'm organizing my class just like the Department of Homeland Security. It's totally top-down. I'm the expert who's trying to tell everyone else what they should learn. So I completely switched about 3 years ago the way I teach. And what I do is on the very first day of class, I take that ultimate symbol of centralized control, which at the university is the syllabus. In your lives, it may be an agenda for a meeting. I rip it up. And I say, you guys are here. You signed up for a class on marine conservation. What do you want to know about marine conservation? And what can you share with us about marine conservation? We build the syllabus on that day from all that collective information. Every student responds with answer to those two questions. We build a syllabus, and we assign one class period to every student who's going to lead that class. And what they do is they lead the class with a topic. They put up on a website what they're going to lead with, what the topic's going to be, maybe some readings, just like I did, but then every other student, at least by midnight, before the night of class, has to respond to that by pulling some riff on that main topic. They might find a YouTube video related to it. They might have a personal experience related to it. they might find another paper that is related to that topic. So when we get into class, every student has a little bit of ownership of that class. And this is what the class, these are real data I'm going to show you. This is what my classes look like now. These are all sources, primary, secondary, literature, government, think tank reports, personal experiences, artwork, new media. All these students are running around getting this information. They might be getting things from another professor, from another class, from another student in the class. They're responding to it and giving it to that lead student. I'm over here on the side. I don't have to do anything. Everyone's coming to class with all this information, and they're sharing it all, and you get not only all these different sensors looking at the changing world of environmental science in this case, but you also get this creative redundancy, things I would never, ever have on my syllabus or be able to speak to with such authority as some of my students can. For example, one year I had a student from China, and he was responding to another student's lead class, which was on shark conservation. One of the things about shark conservation is a lot of sharks are dying these days because they're finned at sea, and their bodies are thrown back, and the fins are taken and sold for shark fin soup in China. Now, I could have said that, and that's about as far as I probably could have got on the topic, except this Chinese student, for his contribution, brought in his wedding menu. And he brought in the wedding menus of his friends, and he said, look, the difference is my wedding menu doesn't have the congee for shark fin soup. And let me tell you how hard it was for my bride and I to have a wedding in Hong Kong without shark fin soup on the menu. And that personal experience, so visceral and so available to all the other students, is something I never could have taught or could have anticipated teaching if I had just gone by my own syllabus. So there's a lot of power out there in these independent respondents. And too often, we try to block it out because we think we know best. So that's all just to say that although this book is largely focused on the security issues, it is applicable to any situation where the future is unpredictable, where there is risk and it's unpredictable. And I think these illustrations give you a start of a range of that. And there's more information on the website, learningfromtheoctopus.com, and my own website, rafesagarin.com. And as I said at the outset, I'm looking forward to talking with you at any time about these issues, and I hope you'll check out the book and we can discuss it further. Thank you.
Our thanks to Raf for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorists Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease, with Rafe Sagarin. Now we open the floor to Q&A. If you have questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone. I'll be passing around the microphone.
Thank you, Professor. I wanted to know if I might pose a bit of a challenge question. What we have in nature is both, of course, a very high price of failure and also the absence of a lot of these normative standards that humans operate under. One of the most major ones I see as an impediment here is fairness, where everyone says, well, if you do that, you might dominate the agenda and I don't get to see what I want to see just because I can't speak as eloquently about it or advocate for it and so on and so forth. So I was wondering if you've taken your idea and either had discussions or have any insights on the fact that we have other normative standards we impose on our processes beyond just effectiveness.
Absolutely. I'm glad you raised that because I try to always mention that just as with my environmental science work, where I fundamentally don't believe that just because I have good science here, it's going to directly become good policy over here, especially after having worked in Congress, I recognize and accept that there are filters in this process between science and policy. There are political filters, economic filters, ethical filters that all must be considered on that pathway. And certainly with this, I don't say take something from nature and stamp it down on our own society, because there would be a lot of violations of all kinds of ethical norms that we have. But rather, use a combination of these ideas from nature and our own ability to be a little thoughtful and to think about, well, how do they translate? What kinds of these ethical thorns are we going to run into, and how do we get around those? That's using a balance between our cognitive mind, our group mind, and the sort of automatic ability to adapt. And I'm saying that we've sort of come a little out of balance in favor of the thoughtful group mind behavior without trusting enough on the adaptational side. So trying to bring that back in a little more. And again, that's why the octopus is there, because it's remarkably like us in the sense that it can use its central brain and its planning to do some amazing things. So octopuses have recently been shown to use coconut shells that they find, and they bring them together to create a suit of armor. Now, that's nothing that's evolutionarily implanted in them, but they also use this kind of automatic response. So everything requires this translation through these kind of norms that you're talking about.
Next question.
Thank you. I would like to hear you comment about the role of the internet. It seems to me, from the what you're describing, it's like a giant octopus. It's very decentralized. It has a lot and I would go so far as to say that in recent history, meaning the last 50 years, there's never been a time where the opportunity for decentralization and wide collaboration has been greater.
Yeah, so the question is about, isn't the internet sort of like an octopus, and don't we have the opportunity for this kind of collaborative, almost octopus-like problem solving more than ever before? And I absolutely agree. I'm a back-to-nature kind of guy, but I also recognize how important technology is towards getting us back to this adaptable state. I'm thinking not just of the internet, but especially distributed cell phone networks. So these are things that can get in anywhere and are everywhere on the planet now. So you have people like Nathan Wolf, who came out of Stanford, and he's developed this emerging infectious disease network where people with cell phones who are way out in the country, where you're most expecting to have a new emergence of a new disease that used to just affect animals that will now affect people because people are hunting bushmeat and they've got bloody animal corpses over their shoulders, and that's where you're likely going to get some transfer, some mutation that can then infect humans. So he's got people out there looking out and reporting back with cell phones on anything they see. That's something that, you know, the WHO, another UN organization, can't really do because they cannot possibly have that penetration way out there. Now, the internet is a curious thing because it is this incredibly adaptable network, but what we've seen, especially recently in places like Syria and other places where governments have been able to cut down on the internet, and this is something I'm just learning about, is that although it was designed as this very decentralized thing, the passageways through ISPs, which is how most of us reach the internet, are sort of centralized hubs that can easily be choked out. And that's one of the problems with the evolution of the internet, is just commercially it became something that has opportunities to choke it out rather than keeping it completely distributed as it was.
Next question.
As an environmentalist, you mentioned invasive species, and when do you realize that invasive species is now part of your, you know, environment? One of the things that, you know, I saw this weekend was the eucalyptus here has become part of our environment and is important to it now.
Yeah. You know, I tend to be much more of a fairly open about change. And as you'll see in the book, a few things on invasive species and then on the environment. I don't believe that there are stable states in nature. For much of the 20th century, people in my field in ecology looked for transitions between certain stable states. I think that I view ecological systems as constantly changing. Invasive species are obviously part of that. There's no way to eliminate them. There's obviously invasive species that we want to look out for and try to get at that earliest point of time. This is another thing. All natural systems go through this consistent cycle. It has different names depending on what level of biology you're looking at, but it's essentially a stage of origination, a stage of proliferation, and a stage of decline. And invasive species are the same way. There's some point when those first invasive species came out. That's why it's really important for some things to have networks of people looking out. Oh, I started to see this weird mussel on my boat hull. Let's look out for those kind of things. But most of the time, we don't see them until they're in this proliferate stage, like zebra mussels in the Great Lakes. And by then, it's far too late to do anything about it. They've taken over, and we're way behind the curve. But those things will eventually come to some state where they're then go into decline, or they may enter into a state where they become more permanently part of the ecosystem, things like eucalyptus. I mean, I certainly cannot conceive of California. My whole knowledge of California from what I smell and what I see and what I hear in the rustling of those leaves is all based around eucalyptus in part. So it's part of my California conception, and yet it is an invasive. And there's a lot of sensitivity for good reasons in all this talk about eliminating invasive species. I would never talk about that, you know, with my immigrant friends who themselves are wondering, especially in Arizona these days, am I the invasive species that's trying to be eliminated? And there's some very good work, I'm trying to remember the author's name, but a paper called The War of the Roses, and he now has a book which is about the language we use, and using these warlike metaphors for ecological things can be a real tricky business. In general, also in the book, I do talk about the value of natural systems that provide us a lot of security that we either stomp over or ignore at our peril. And I'm talking about things like wetlands and mangroves that provide a lot of natural security for us for free, and yet often we pave them over, we cut through them. Hurricane Katrina was a Category 3 storm when it came into the Gulf. And yet the Army Corps of Engineers had cut a path called Mr. Go, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, which was a nice straight path straight through those protective wetlands to let ships more quickly get from the Mississippi to the Gulf. And that path was like a beautiful red carpet for Katrina to just go marching right up into New Orleans. And to their credit, the Corps has finally realized that that thing needs to be shut down and hopefully replanted with wetlands because they're a much better protective service. So I talk about some of those things in the book.
We'll take the last question if you have any other questions. No questions?
I was thinking, I don't know exactly what to ask, but I want to hear you talk more about your relationship to expertise, because it feels like we live in a society so built on anointing certain people experts and then listening to them over and over again about whether it's healthcare or national security, public education, and you both personally have transcended some of the kind of borderlands of what your PhD says is your expertise, but also looking at like what you said about how you structure your classroom, you kind of flip expertise. And so I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you relate to that.
Yeah, I think, like I said at the outset, and that's a question from Courtney Martin, who's a super blogger and writes amazing stuff, so I'm glad she's here. From the outset, I talked about my feelings about biology, and you sort of get beat into you as a biologist that you're an expert in almost nothing. And so I've always had this skeptical relationship to experts, because I don't think anyone is an expert in anything. But like you said, we do sort of self-anoint people and say, oh, you know, they're an expert in this. I've been called an expert in security, which scares me, and I would really be scared if someone called me an expert in biology. But all I can say is that time and time again, what I find is that the people who provide the most wisdom to me, for example, as I was developing this book and talking to classes full of first responders, were not people that most anyone else outside of their immediate circle would identify as an expert. They were just people who experienced something that was of interest. So, you know, talking to, again, soldiers just coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, well, you know, you could say they're an expert in something. They're not society's expert in something, but they have more wisdom than anyone else. And this is something, I've just finished another book that'll be out in July called Observation and Ecology. And it's about how ecology as a science is becoming much more open to different forms of knowledge. And one of those, several of those forms of knowledge are what we call traditional ecological knowledge, also what we call local ecological knowledge. That is knowledge that people who work very closely with the earth in some way, as fishermen, or they may be multi-generational tribes that have lived close to the earth, have incredible knowledge that's not academic knowledge. And we're also seeing that citizens provide an unbelievable amount of knowledge just by going out and watching birds or counting when flowers are forming. So I think we're starting to reconceptualize more generally expertise and recognizing that everyone has some expertise. And the way you see it, as you mentioned, you do have to let go a little bit. As a teacher, I had to let go of my sense of control and just see what happens. And what happens has been great, and the students love it because they just become more part of it. So I always encourage people that it takes some leadership to not be a leader. And that's something that's a little hard to get across, but if you just take that one little step, you'll be amazed at what comes back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Rafe for his comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 190th of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.